This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Welcome to Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. Just me today, Johnny Lupinacci. You know, he has work to do on campus and he's really busy. But Jess, how are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing great. Week is full of promise. Let's take it on.
Let's take it on. Let's move this on. I tell you what, though, love our classes and sessions, segments that we're recording. Great guests we've been having and have one today. He is the Assistant Director of Innovation at the University of Mississippi and a leader in AI literacy for educators. He's been ahead of the curve, helping educators navigate the rapidly evolving world of artificial intelligence with a thoughtful, balanced approach. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Mark Watkins. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for that introduction, Tim. And I hope to be behind the curve at some point because I think you guys know this has been quite a bit to deal with. But happy to sit down and talk and hopefully get some more insights about, just how AI is currently evolving right before our eyes.
It's really evolving. In fact, you made me just think now of a new first question, which is, I feel, though, behind all the time when we're talking about AI in education. I know when people talk to me, they're like, Tim, you got to understand where you're at, what you're talking about. You're way ahead of the main population. And I'm kind of like going, well, then, wow, people must be really behind because there's something happening every day. And I feel woefully unprepared in already what's already been happening and that I feel like I'm always playing catch up. Mark, I wonder if you can counsel me out of my despair.
I share your despair and your challenges too. I think everyone does. What's happened with the deployment of these tools is that they're outpacing even experts' attentions. We had an update from Google recently with Notebook LM, which is a standalone product within Google Labs. It's been on the market for about a year, but they did a very small update where you could take any document and turn it into a podcast, right. Which changed the sort of like dynamic too and made people like the situation where we're right now too. Well, wait, are people still going to be listening to live human podcasts or having AI generated voices? And, you know, something as small, as simple as that, because Google has tons of these different projects going on live in Google Labs right now, and they just added it from another project called Illuminate into Notebook LM, changed that dynamic. And now everyone's kind of reacting to this. And there are probably three or four dozen of those different types of things happening every month or 2 months. Right. So, it's completely outpaced our attention. I think that we just want to focus on small areas if we can too, to just sort of digest what's happening too and put it into greater context.
Yeah.
There's no way anyone can keep track of all this. There's just not.
Okay. So I'm normal. Okay. I mean, sort of. I know Jess has got the look going, well, Tim, I mean, that depends. It's debatable.
It's a little debatable. I mean, there's nothing wrong with you, Tim. We love you. And, normal, it's overrated.
Well, hey, if you want to weigh in on that, 608-557-8577, that's our mailbag number, so that you can comment. Yeah, I mean, I guess if you want to comment on my mental stability, go for it. But talk about Mark Watkins and artificial intelligence. Are you feeling behind? What are you doing to keep pace with this so that we are moving in this? If you're an educator, your students are using it. Are you using it? How are they using it? Do you wish you could use it differently? These are all the questions around artificial intelligence for educators that keep coming up. Mark, in fact, your latest piece on the Substack, you bring together this combination of something that a lot of people remember, which is, I remember when the calculator made the scene and that changed things. But you are talking about going like, this might not really be a calculator moment as much as this might be a culture moment. G- give me a sense for the listener. What do you mean?
Yeah, I think when ChatGPT publicly was released, goodness, it's only been 22 months since that happened. Can you believe that? It's just been 22 months since that occurred. A lot of people were sort of grasping to analogies for it too. And one of them they picked up on was this is a lot like a calculator. And that was a very comforting sort of comparison to it too. But generative AI is so far beyond ChatGPT. It's going into audio, multimodal facets too. And it's really impacting our sort of daily lives in many different ways. We just haven't really had time to process it. John Warner, who also writes on Substack and is author of many different books too, he had a really great post here about how there is a private company that is using AI voice to take a person's collective knowledge and organize that after they die so they can then interact with their relatives. It's called, being called grief tech. And it's just like mind-boggling that we've gone from a text-generating software to using the generative AI tools to theoretically create a sort of virtual avatar of yourself so that your loved ones can interact with them. So I think this technology is so far beyond a calculator. It really is becoming a cultural technology like Google did for search, and also how Wikipedia and maybe even how writing actually impacted human condition and communication.
Yeah. Thinking about that, though, too, the way you just said that is to make me wonder. And John Warner, we love him. He's been on the show quite a few times talking about this. And, you know, again, his very cautionary, if not somewhat frightened, sense of going like, wait a minute, people, you're jumping on board too quickly and making some pretty bold assumptions about what it can do and what it can't. And especially in the realm of writing, and we always talk about that. But I see this too, like you do, though, Mark, and it isn't a calculator. It's just not. And I remember when I realized that was when I was showing students on the campus where I was working at this, and one of the students made, to me, a really profound leap that said, this is different. She said, it's not like Google. It's like I have an assistant. And that was that moment where I was like, yeah, wait, this is different. This isn't an information retrieval machine. This is way different. And so according to that student, it's an assistant. And in fact, now all my work with AI professional development that I'm giving myself says too, and if you want the best use of it, don't treat it like Google, because you already got Google to do that. Treat it as your intern, your assistant, your friend. And that kind of creeps people out, though.
It does creep people out, I think, for a good reason. And I actually am very aligned with John's thoughts about this is happening way too quickly. I just want us to be more cautious about how we quickly we adopt these things. OpenAI demoed their voice assistant, which is now available in all the different pro plans for ChatGPT, where you can talk to it in real time. Mm-hmm. And not only can you talk to it, but you can change the tone of it too. You can make it speak softly to it. The whole idea is that this can become incredibly persuasive to you. Right. Now, obviously, if this is good used for good, this could be incredibly helpful for people that need assistance with mental health at any point in time of the day, too, with students needing tutoring. But if you imagine a conservative or liberal legislature getting a hold of this technology and just censoring information based off of that political instance, you can kiss book bans goodbye, because then you're just going to basically say, well, here's this wonderful app that is connected to the world that's your personal assistant, but it's programmed with our values. And to me, that's what makes this so daunting. That's just happened and we haven't even really had time to process it. We certainly haven't had any time for legislation to catch up with this in any way, shape, or form. And we haven't just really had time to talk about to our students about what's the best way we could use this to actually help you learn versus offloading those skills. So it's just massive changes that are happening now because all the infrastructure of our world exists through the clouds. And these changes can now be shipped in a few hours and updated to existing apps that we already have on our phones and our laptops.
All right. So we know all this. We wish it would slow down. We know, even, quote, we're behind. But it is going forward. And you did say something there that recognized this, though. And I'm with this, too. I see real potential benefits, in what you really just said, this ability to potentially create better learning conditions and or how students, again, like way beyond, like it's not a copy plagiarism machine. It's like, mm-hmm. if that's what you're worried about, sorry, you've missed the conversation. The ability to potentially have a student, you know, and my background is in teaching and education, mm-hmm. and some of the quote adaptive technologies we've had out there to help students with learning difficulties, right? That I can really see this, as you just said, the multimodal aspect more and more too, the ability for it, AI, to see, to then talk about what it sees. You're just thinking about that going, boy, from an adaptive technologies position, this is going to really be profoundly helpful for certain learners to really engage when they in places and times that they never could in the past.
Oh, absolutely. And we've been testing these different features of the University of Mississippi since about 6 months before ChatGPT was publicly released. Mm-hmm. We started back in May of 2022 with GPT-3, the precursor to OpenAI's big chatbot. And some of the things we've been testing on too are AI for reading assistance, for note-taking, for tutoring. And we've noticed too that those are some profound potential changes that this happens. When you would give a student who has who is neurodiverse or who is working on their second or third language an AI reading assistant that can take any digital document and change the actual phrasing to summarize it at their reading level, at their language, that can be absolutely game-changing. Mm-hmm. The sort of sweet spot for education, though, is how do we keep this from being how do we keep this being a tool that helps those students versus this when I deployed it for my students? They're like, thank you so much, Mr. Watkins. You just gave me a tool that's going to turn my world into Cliff Notes on demand. And I said, well, no, your close reading skills are actually pretty valuable. We'd like to keep that. So we're going to balance this. And one way I could do that, and one way I talk about this to educators too, is that it's not just students using this technology. And what you said before is completely true. This is not about a cheating tool anymore. This is about a transformative tool, and it can absolutely transform that experience and that relationship between a teacher and a learner. So we want to be thoughtful about this, obviously, and be open about it. So I think one thing that we are trying here at the University of Mississippi for the first time, hopefully this is going to work, fingers crossed, mm-hmm. is that we're advocating for open disclosure from all parties. So if students use OpenAI or any other sort of generative AI feature, we want them to disclose that. But we also want teachers to do that too if they're doing this in instructional design, because we think being open about this is going to be the way we want to go forward, because we really would like to avoid a lot of the really bad situations with surveillance capital through AI detectors that are not reliable. And, you know, if you really want to focus on this stuff, the old AI detectors, they call them old now, they are really getting to the point where there's a lot more long-term tracking software that's coming online now too, that's pretty concerning.
Thinking about that, so back to that kind of cheating and whether we can catch it or not, I know some of the professional develop I've been involved in is just, you know, and this was always the issue when you're talking about, you know, potentially telling a student that they broke the academic dishonesty policy on campus and the ramifications that can have and the ability to be, you know, truly factual on that. And, you know, these AI detection softwares that are out there, you know, they're quote false positives or sometimes to the point where you can't really rely on them. And, you know, I think Ethan Mollick has really put forward this kind of idea of saying like, you know, look, there's really not good AI detection. Once somebody knows how to use AI, it really does become different. I do that. I mean, I've now created, guess what? I'm not wealthy. I don't have the ability to hire a high paid editor, but I've really worked hard with my ChatGPT, the one that I'm paying for the pro plan, to create, you know, my own kind of personal editor for the stuff mm-hmm. I write. And I think I like that. And I don't feel like I'm cheating when I use it to help me like any editor would that I could pay a lot of money for. But it, you know, and that just made me think though too about this. Think about now how that kind of leveled me up, where I never had access to an editor. By having a skill set of learning how to use GPT or any of the generative AIs, I can now potentially have, you know, my own editor. And so how many people who are really thinking about producing quality writing could have the benefit of having their own personal AI editor.
I think you're absolutely right. And the challenges that we face in education are getting more faculty on board with this, because right now what we're seeing is the deep siloing of different sort of like perspectives on it. We see early adopters, but we also see people who are just having a visceral reaction and wanting to be off the sidelines. And the other version of this is, of course, we have people who are just still on the sidelines and not coming off with tip. So I think what we have to do is give them more professional development opportunities.
I was going to say, I mean, the more I do this, the more I'm convinced that it, particularly in higher education, let's just really focus on this. I know, you know, I've worked in K-12 too, and I've seen actually, I think I see better adoption rates with actually some teachers right now who are sometimes more adopting it just for the simple fact that their students are using it already, and so they need to adopt it. But in higher ed, faculty, in fact, I at a campus I was associated with, there was a very, you know, kind of like this hysterical banning reaction, which was, you know, look, just ban it and make it go away. And it's something I don't ever want to have to deal with. And why can't we all just get on board with a ban? It's like, sorry, you can't ban it. What we can do, though, is develop our own professional dispositions, our own professional knowledge as educators about realizing that we've got something now in our hands that can potentially radically transform education. I, as a faculty member, am scared. I don't know what to do necessarily, but I know I need to do something. If we can get people in that realm to kind of drop the banning, the skepticism, but say, how do we help you recognize how this tool, and then they say this cultural tool, and maybe that's even part of it, is to help right away and going like, look, this isn't a calculator. This is a big change. And we know it. We see you. We understand the fear, the hesitation, the trepidation you're bringing. Let's talk about this in ways, though, to say, did you know, or is it possible? Can you think of this? And for me, one of the first things I thought about was just having faculty potentially look at one assignment they do in their syllabus and say, can we take one of your assignments and just start to imagine how we might change it with AI? And that kind of using that as the stepping stone into AI professional development. I wonder if you had some thoughts on that, Mark.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a great idea, too. We do multiple institutes for, each year that sometimes are half-day workshops. But for our winter institutes, a three-day-long workshop with faculty where they bring their own assignments, their own material to, and they get exposed to different AI tools. But it's important for us to both keep early adopters and skeptics in the same room together so they can talk about this and iron it out. And I think that's really the pathway forward, too, and I would hope other institutions would adopt some rethinking of professional development too, not as just one-off activities, but to look at this as a continuum now. Because if you do a week-long professional development situation for AI in the summer, you're going to have to redo that again at some point in time during the year. It's going to, at least for the foreseeable future.
Man, he is the Assistant Director of Academic Innovation at the University of Mississippi. Mark Watkins is our guest. Mark, if people want to find you or find any of the your professional development and writing that you're doing, where should they go?
So I have a Substack called Rhetorica. It's free to read and will always be free. You can also follow me on Blue Sky and Twitter at Mark Watkins. And I'm happy to connect with people too. Just shoot me an email. You can also go to my University of Mississippi homepage for that and see what we're doing with academic innovations, groups, events, and our institute.
Mark Watkins, man, he is our guest. Hey, and you know what, Tune, if you have a question for Mark, we'll get it to him, put it in our mailbag, 608-557-8577, 608-557-8577. That's the mailbag number for any questions and comments that you have. Mark, thank you for busting pencils.
And now for your moment of zen. I had always insisted that a good education was a synthesis of book learning and involvement in social action, that each enriched the other. I wanted my students to know that the accumulation of knowledge, while fascinating in itself, is not sufficient as long as so many people in the world have no opportunity to experience that fascination. Catch us on Friday for First Downs and Friday Night Lights with in-house civic media host Chad Holmes, and keep busting pencils with us.